This is Rocketing Ahead from Soundprint and producer Richard Paul.
Today, outer space is free, unscarred by conflict. No nation holds a concession there. It must remain this way.
What the world needs today, even more than a giant leap into outer space, is a giant step toward peace.
Through the 1950s, politicians continued to fight over whether or not the U.S. should make a full-scale manned push into outer space. The scientific and academic communities joined the fight. All these years later, we can see the impact of that decision. Universities aligned themselves with federal big science projects, and when they did, they fundamentally altered the nature and the mission of the university in America. That's according to Bill Leslie, a professor of the history of science and technology at Johns Hopkins University.
It certainly blurred the conventional distinctions between what universities do, which is supposed to be the pursuit of higher knowledge, and what a defense agency or the government would do, which is very applied missions.
So, Leslie says, it wasn't uncommon at a place like MIT for a student thesis to be on the design of a missile.
That talent went into that missile instead of into something else. And so that kind of opportunity cost is very real.
After World War II, big science projects funded by the government became more and more the norm.
The government has long been the largest single funder of university research. That was true in the 1940s, 1950s. And after the war, it's really three agencies. It's the Department of Defense, it's the National Institutes of Health, and increasingly, after its creation, NASA.
He says all this federal money washing around changed the nature of science education in America.
If you put all your high-tech energy into military R&D, you're going to get very high performance, very expensive equipment. So you get an integrated circuit that's very good for a Polaris missile. That isn't very useful in the commercial sector.
At the same time that Cold War competition and the Pentagon's effort to put Americans in space were changing the university in America, the space race was also altering the nation's education at the elementary and secondary level. Here's the Smithsonian's Roger Lanius.
In 1958, the passage of the National Defense Education Act, which established a federal program to provide resources to train scientists and engineers, as well as teaching kids about science and math.
A delightful summer outing to the zoo, with human youngsters meeting animal youngsters. What could be more pleasant? And what could spoil it quicker than the words back to school?
The NDEA, as it's called, came after Sputnik, and many people believe it came about because of Sputnik. Carl Kasel is a professor of education history and public policy at Brown University and the leading authority on the history of the NDEA. Kasel says the push to change American schools, to take them back to basics and to focus more on math and science, was well underway when Sputnik went up.
It was coming on the scene when progressive education was just all out of oomph, didn't have much social guts to it, was called life adjustment education. And there had already been a great deal of criticism of it in the early 1950s, long before Sputnik.
How are your teeth? Have you thought of them lately? Well, that's what we want to talk about your teeth.
1945. That was the heyday of this life adjustment education stuff. And to the critics, there was just too darn much of how to write a business letter and how about your first date and that kind of stuff.
This is a story about what to do on a date. It begins one early summer afternoon. It begins with Jeff and Kay and Nick.
That was the stereotype that the critics were making. They're saying no hard math, no hard physics. And the Soviet Union was a convenient whip to lash people with.
What courses are you taking next year?
Oh, my schedule's already made out. In the ninth grade, you have to take mathematics and English and history.
No science?
Well, I had my choice of taking general science this year or next, but I put it off a year.
The Commissioner of Education, who was commissioner when the NDEA was approved, was a guy named Lawrence Durthick, and he went to the Soviet Union in 57 and came back with these somewhat alarmed reports that the Soviets are out to beat us, they make no bones about it, and they're really doing terrific schooling.
But Kaysel says that what the Soviets were good at wasn't schooling per se, but instead
rigorously identifying talent and then spending a lot of effort on that minority of kids to make them into a technical elite. And they got Sputnik out by focusing on a small percentage who were very, very talented.
Cold War fear had injected itself into a debate that had been going on since the late 1930s. Back then, wise heads in the science world were calling for a return to basics so that we could compete with the Germans, who we were told were beating us at science. Now, it was the Russians. There were new kinds of learning that came out of NDEA. Not all of them good for kids.
You can't take 3 from 2. 2 is less than 3, so you look at the 4 in the tens place. Now that's really 4 tens, so you make it 3 tens. Regroup, and you change the 10 to 10 ones, and you add them to the 2 and get 12, and you take away 3. That's 9. Is that clear?
That's Tom Lehrer singing about the most infamous outgrowth of NDEA, new math. Bob Drake is a professor of education at the University of Cincinnati.
University mathematicians had complained for generations that students coming out of public schools had very little understanding of the mathematics they had learned. And the original new math movement was to correct that problem.
New math was actually part of a larger outgrowth of NDEA that included new physics and new chemistry, according to education historian David Tyack.
It had to do with the Cold War. So what do? We hire scientists, physicists, and chemists, and biologists to come in and remake the curriculum.
Unfortunately, in the case of math, he says they turn to the wrong people to do the job.
From the 3, you then use 1 to make 10 ones, and you know why 4 plus minus 1 plus 10 is 14 minus 1, because addition is commutative, right? And so you got...
The new math curriculum was designed not by educators, but by mathematicians, people who knew virtually nothing about the way kids process information. Scores of American young people wasted years mastering a type of math that was gone by the time they got to high school. The overall effect of NDEA, according to historian Carl Kaysel?
It was pushing for math and science to be more primary and essential than English and social studies, whether you like that or not.
Hooray for new math, new math. It won't do you a bit of good to read new math. It's so simple, so very simple, that only a child can do it.
Throughout this period, America continued to try to get into space. Vanguard had been a Navy program. After the Vanguard explosion, the task of putting up an American satellite was moved over to the Army.
At Huntsville, Alabama, a sudden meeting has been called by General John B. Medeiros, commanding general of the Army Ballistic Missile Agency.
Wernher von Braun's team of Germans, now working out of the Redstone Arsenal in Alabama, along with the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California, had been given 90 days to put America in orbit.
The decision was passed down. Modify the Redstone ballistic missile, the Army's most powerful weapons carrier over a 200-mile range.
George Ludwig was a graduate student doing IGY work for the geophysicist James Van Allen. They were at the University of Iowa building the satellite for the Vanguard program. When the decision was made to move the satellite work to JPL, Ludwig says,
I collected all of the hardware that I had, the plans, my notebooks, plus my family, into our car and drove out to Pasadena, California, where I worked at JPL and to help convert our instrument, I put it in final shape for launch on the Army vehicle.
At Cape Canaveral, Florida, the Army's Jupiter C rocket is readied for America's second attempt to launch a space satellite.
The Von Braun team got the job done, and America had a satellite aloft.
Some 3 minutes later, Explorer is in orbit, broadcasting to the world its coded scientific data.
The experiment was originally designed to look at cosmic rays. Instead, when it got into space, we found something that we didn't understand at all initially.
Explorer had a Geiger counter on board that started giving the scientists readings that were off the charts. Gil Moore was another IGY graduate student at the time.
They got the expected rise in concentration of cosmic radiation up to maybe 1,000 miles, and then what the heck? Van Allen and his guys could not figure out what the heck was happening. They thought their equipment was malfunctioning.
What had happened, they learned later, was a new phenomenon in space science.
And they all sat around and said, oh, ho, ho, I think maybe we have encountered a new phenomenon here instead of an equipment failure.
It would be called the Van Allen radiation belts, and it changed forever mankind's approach to space exploration.
The discovery of the Van Allen radiation belts was an incredibly important scientific event. We discovered that the sun has explosions that occur rather routinely during an 11-year sunspot cycle. And a lot of the radiation coming from the sun gets trapped in the region which is now commonly known as the Van Allen radiation belt region.
This, of course, was a terrible shock to science fiction fans.
American University's Howard McCurdy.
Most of the proposals for things like space stations had anticipated that we would not use low Earth orbits, but that we would use these orbits that were about 1,000 miles out.
To facilitate this refueling operation, we will establish an advanced base in the orbit, 1,000 miles above the Earth.
The discovery of the Van Allen radiation belts was the first touch of reality in the fantasies of space exploration advocates, because they had viewed outer space as being an essentially benign environment, like scuba diving.
Our space satellite will have the shape of a wheel, measuring 200 feet across. Its outside rim will contain living and working quarters for a crew of 50 men.
We didn't realize that there would be a region of space that was so heavily charged with energetic particles that we would not be able to stay there. We didn't realize this would be quite a hazard to space flight.
Here's the first bucket of cold water that gets thrown in the face of everybody.
And if you're in the middle of those, you just can't stay.
They're susceptible to radiation poisoning. If there's a solar maximum during any of these voyages, the astronauts have to be shielded, or they will get the equivalent of a radiation burn. It creates this barrier, which is safe to quickly pass through, but you clearly wouldn't want to live there.
The entire wheel will slowly rotate at 3 revolutions per minute. The resulting centrifugal force will produce an artificial gravity for the men in the rim.
We knew immediately that shielding would be necessary in order to operate in those regions.
One answer is lead, but since you're trying to keep the mass of the capsule down, that's impractical.
A lead-lined rocket just couldn't lift off. As rocket pioneer Conrad Dannenberg explains,
to generate the large thrust that you need to make the vertical takeoff, that was a very demanding area. Once you have finally ignited your rockets, you have a big problem with heat transfer. Your rocket combustion temperature is much higher than the melting temperature of steel. So even if you build your rocket from steel, it has a tendency to melt through and to have a big hole in your rocket engine.
When we ask about the true lasting legacy of Sputnik, this is it. In the light of history, this is the takeaway. The grand scientific discovery, the Van Allen radiation belts, are the capstone. Now that America had a significant space science achievement under its belt, Roger Lania says the coalition around Senator Johnson called for more. More focus on science and more money for science.
Some people were proposing that you should create a Department of Space. Another wanted a cabinet post that was a Department of Science and Technology.
The pressure forced Eisenhower to make large and important structural changes to the United States government. Eisenhower created an Office of Presidential Science Advisor.
And that was an important step because it now had inside the White House a person who really spoke for science and technology.
The president also created the Advanced Research Projects Agency, or ARPA, which in 1972 became DARPA, the agency that created the Internet. He also streamlined the space components of the Defense Department, largely by creating the most visible legacy of the Sputnik launch, NASA.
Project Mercury, the country's first manned spaceflight program, was given the go-ahead just 1 week after NASA was formed on October 1st, 1958.
To give you a sense of the proportion of these changes, Roger Lanius points out,
those reorganizations are only dwarfed by the creation of the Department of Homeland Security in the aftermath of 9/11.
But each proposal must be weighed in the light of a broader consideration, the need to maintain balance in and among national programs. balance between the private and the public economy, balance between the cost and hoped for advantages, balance between the clearly necessary and the comfortably desirable.
So this is what President Eisenhower was complaining about in his military-industrial complex speech. Of course, the president who followed him had another agenda: beating the Russians to the moon and, if possible, continuing to clobber the Republicans.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
The programs he advocated took us to the moon, which at the time, in the middle of the Cold War, seemed much more important than it does today. 50 years out, we ask, would the nation be better off if we'd spent that money on something else, say, mass transit or alternative fuels or urban redesign? Maybe. Science, as we said, is an ongoing, changing enterprise. Perhaps it's for the future to know whether history will change today's science, and if it does, whether that science will change history. Rocketing Ahead was written, produced, and narrated by Richard Paul. It was edited by Moira Rankin. We'd like to thank David Krasnow at Studio 360 and Bill Buesenberg, Stephen Dick and Colin Fries at the NASA History Office, and Christina Rodriguez at the Lyndon Johnson Library. Our music was composed and arranged by Lenny Williams. This program is part of the Out of This World project. More information on the web at outofthisworldscience.org.
Funding for this program was provided by the National Science Foundation, where discoveries begin.